The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone. Welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you from the beautiful studios of WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley. And we're, of course, streaming live on the magic of the Internet, WWDBAM.com. Boomer Generation Radio, brought to you by the Kendall Corporation, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging, and we invite you to learn more about Kendall, which is K-E-N-D-A-L, by visiting www.discoverkendall.org or give them a call toll-free at 888-759-0128. Boomer Generation Radio, you can let us know some opinions and ideas. You can catch us on boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And we invite you to click on Boomer Generation Radio on Facebook and like the Facebook page. And we are very pleased to welcome Dr. Don Friedman, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine, Volunteer Faculty at the Jefferson Medical College here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That's a lot to get. That's a lot to get on the business card. But Dr. Friedman, welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio. It's a pleasure to see you again and welcome you to the microphones for another visit here, because I know you've been here before and always bring to us some very, very interesting aspects of what you're doing at Jefferson. And so welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Rabbi Estress. Great to be here.
So let's get right to it. You've written for my website, JewishSacredAging.com. You've written some other things and have really invested a lot of your time in attempting to bring to medical students this concept of understanding their own spirituality and how that can impact their practice of medicine when they get out into the real world. Could you walk us through some of the things that you do and some of the things that you're finding with these medical students that have opened their eyes and perhaps, in your opinion, may impact how they choose to practice their profession?
Well, one of the main things I'm involved with at Jefferson is teaching a course called The Healer's Art, which was developed by Rachel Naomi Remen, who's a very humanistic physician who herself has dealt a lot with chronic disease. She had Crohn's disease when she was 15, and by the time she was 18, had a colostomy. This was at the time in the 50s when there wasn't good treatment for Crohn's disease. So she's very aware of the human aspects of medical care and has devised this course for first-year students, which is an elective. It's now taught in over 80 medical schools, and Jefferson is one of them. And it's a discovery model course where we as the faculty are supposed to be facilitators more than teachers, where the students get together for 5 sessions and discuss different topics. And the topics range from the first one, actually, the first week is on wholeness, characteristics that the students have that they feel are being lost by their becoming physicians, things that aren't encouraged for them to develop in medical school that are really very much a part of their being, and things that they have to give up in order to become physicians and how they can try to hold on to those aspects of their lives. And the second and third sessions are on grief and loss, where they have to share losses in their lives with each other, and how it affected them and how they dealt with them, how they went through a grieving process. The fourth session is on awe and mystery, and that's a very difficult subject to teach. It's very difficult for most physicians that we can't always explain everything that happens, and there is an element of mystery in medicine. And the fifth session is on service. Medicine is service, not just a job, but as a service. So the thing that happens in these sessions is that the students really share with each other. A lot of them don't know each other very well. It's their first year. And we encourage them to talk. It's not an easy process because we allow for silence. If someone doesn't say anything, we allow for a period of silence, and then eventually someone says something very meaningful, usually. And the students learn through this process certain things that I think are helpful to them to become better physicians in terms of compassion and empathy and understanding things that patients may go through.
We were talking before we went on air about this a study that I pulled off from one of the aging institutes that I get emails from about the role of empathy in medicine, but specifically this concept of teaching empathy to medical students. And I know you just mentioned it. How does, first of all, could you define it? And how do you approach this in teaching medical students? So the perception of these are men and women are so focused on training that I guess you're trying to open this door to their humanity.
Well, one of the things that's really been well documented is that medical students come to medical school with a lot of empathetic caring and wanting to make a difference. And they've actually measured empathy levels. There's a Jefferson empathy scale that's been developed.
Let me just give me the definition, working definition of the word empathy.
Empathy is really to make an effort to try to understand the other person, in this case, the patient's thoughts and feelings. It's putting yourself in the patient's shoes. It's kind of the concept of walk a mile in my shoes. Mm-hmm. Try to understand what the patient may be thinking and feeling, and yet keeping a certain distance, not taking on those feelings per se. That sort of moves into the aspect of sympathy. Empathy is just trying to understand what the other person is feeling. Compassion goes a step further. You can't have compassion for someone without having empathy first. You first must understand what they're thinking and feeling and going through. And compassion adds the component of wanting to make a difference in the patient's life or the other person's life, if it's a friend or family member. So those are the two things that I think are important in medicine. And unfortunately, the studies have shown that by the third year, all the compassion is squeezed out of the medical students. They're working on the floors in the hospital. They're dealing with the fact that they're just learning things and they don't know a lot, and they're being asked to do a lot of very kind of menial tasks. And sometimes empathy isn't really modeled for them very well by some of the role models they come across in terms of older physicians or residents. And so by the time they're in their third or fourth year, the studies have shown that the empathy levels precipitously drop in medical students.
You mentioned before one of the first things that you teach is this concept of what a student has to give up. I think there may be a perception that, well, you're going into medicine and you're not going to give up anything. You're going to acquire. I mean, this is a tremendous calling, but yet what does that student have to give up? That's a very fascinating concept.
Well, it's a really, I mean, we do spend a whole session on that aspect of wholeness. And the students, there are different aspects of that. On one level, students talk about things like, oh, I used to play the flute, and now I don't do that because I don't have time, or I don't have time for my friends or family. So that's one aspect, or I don't have time really to live my life because they're so busy studying and going to class. So that's one aspect of it, is the real specific things in their life that they're not doing that are really important to them. The second aspect, which is part of the wholeness concept, is what characteristics do they have that are really great characteristics, like compassion and concern for others and so forth, that are not really encouraged by medical training today. And things that would really make them terrific doctors. As you know, there are two aspects to it. One is the knowledge that comes with being a physician, but the other is having that sense of compassion and empathy and being able to relate to a patient and those aspects of their personality that might help them in that part of being a physician are not encouraged. So that's part of some of the things they give up. And I think they're aware of that. Especially in their third year, they have this sense of Some of them feel this is not what I came to medical school for. And actually, there have been incidences of students burning out, even in their third year, because they're not having a sense of satisfaction that they were looking for.
This class is for medical students,
yes,
and it introduces them to all these concepts. Have you been involved with or do you know of situations where this class is offered for physicians who have already been out, let's say 5-10 years, who can look who look on a perspective of, I've done this, this is what I've learned, this is what I need to know more of, or be in touch with a greater sense of my own humanity?
This is available. For example, Rachel Remen, who developed this course, has these incredible workshops out in California that she has developed for physicians. One of them is called Finding Meaning in Medicine. Another one is Storytelling for Physicians and Healthcare. It's really storytelling for healthcare providers. Another one is, she recently started, is on Awe and Mystery, that whole subject that I mentioned before. Now, the interesting thing is, and I've been to all three of these workshops, they're usually about 75 people, because that's a restricted number that she can have in the class. And I would say out of the 75 people, they're usually 10 physicians. The other people are hospice workers, hospice nurses, school nurses, social workers.
Any clergy?
Very few.
Yeah, wow.
There are a few clergy. But, of course, the clergy and the chaplains and spiritual directors have their own programs. This is really geared more toward healthcare. So it's available. You know, I don't think as many physicians go to it that might benefit from it. But the general consensus is that by the time students are in their third or fourth years and then residents and out in the world, people are so focused on the scientific and medical aspects of taking care of a patient that some of these other aspects are lost. And you really, I mean, it's a self-selective group that will go to these courses.
Obviously. We're speaking with Dr. Don Friedman, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine and on the volunteer faculty at Jefferson Medical College, on some very, very fascinating issues of training medical students and having them get in touch with their own humanity. Part of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by a very good friend of ours, the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott, which provides concierge financial consulting and planning services. The Hecht Investment Group uses a formal investment process as their foundation, and as we've told you before, clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to their questions. And as many of us know, there are few needs greater than our own when it comes to personal financial planning as we look forward to this next stage of our own life. And the Hecht Investment Group provides experience, guidance, and an efficient management process that is very important in today's environment. Additionally, Hecht and his team can assist you in connecting to the investment banking departments who specialize in assisting middle market companies achieve their strategic goals. So we invite you to contact Peter Hecht and the Hecht Investment Group at toll-free number, which is 855-289-2168. You can visit them on the hechtinvestmentgroup.com. And the Hecht Investment Group is also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and in Facebook. They're part of Janney Montgomery Scott, which is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and the SIPC. That's Peter Hecht and the Hecht Investment Group, 855-289-2168 or hechtinvestmentgroup.com. We're back with Dr. Don Friedman here on Boomer Generation Radio, coming to you on WWDB AM 860 here in beautiful Philadelphia, Bala-Cynwyd. Streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And again, a reminder, you can contact the show on Boomer Generation Radio at gmail.com and like us on the Facebook page for Boomer Generation Radio. Dr. Friedman, one of the issues that you're involved with, which I find absolutely fascinating, and I'm hoping you can just walk us through this thing. These ideas of taking medical students in the midst of this unbelievable pressured training and having them write plays? I mean, I can imagine. I can only imagine when I teach at the seminary that I teach at in New York for our movement, the Hebrew Union College, taking fourth and fifth year students who are so focused on getting out and getting into the real world, and saying, "Now we're going to walk you through writing a play about your journey," which could be very fascinating. So tell me about this, if you can, about medical students at Jefferson.
Well, this is a program that was just started by Dr. Salvatore Mangione, who's the head of the Medicine and Humanities program at Jefferson, which is a program that takes a certain number of students. I think it's like 25 or so each year, and the students have to commit to this for 4 years. And the aim of the program is to use the humanities to help students, medical students, get in touch with themselves and get in touch with the ideas of compassion toward patients, using the arts to help them. They do many things. They attend plays. They write papers. They even, it was written up in the Inquirer, took drawing lessons at the Fleischer Gallery, I believe, twice a week for 2 months, and all of them commented that taking drawing lessons increased exponentially their observational skills with patients.
How?
I think just by learning how to observe better and relating to the patient by being a better observer.
How do you assign, if I'm a medical student at Jeff, okay, and is this open to like a specific year? Is it open to everybody?
Well, they start in their first year, and then they have to stay in this program. They do the regular coursework that everyone else does, but they do these other projects. So this theater project was Dr. Mangione got a grant for this. He was interested in studying whether students and also faculty members and residents. It was a combination of people in these classes. Would increase their sense of compassion by taking a theater class. So essentially there were two classes. One met on Sunday night, and Monday night was totally outside the curriculum. The students had to come at night. And we were taught by a dramaturg, Kitson O'Neill, and a director, Craig Giddings, who worked with the Arden Theater. It was done through the Lantern Theater. Arrangements were made through the Lantern, and we met with these two people who are real theater people once a week from November through March. And it started out as really acting classes, where we did a lot of improv and learned how to observe each other and interact and be creative. It was a really creative process. And then as time went on, we did read scenes from plays and analyze them and so forth. And then as time went on, each of us wrote a play that could be anything. It could be based on your experience. It could be something totally imaginative. And I must tell you, the degree of creativity and imagination and skill that came out from these plays were really amazing. There was a wide range. It was interesting. One of the classes, the Sunday night class, was more first and second year students. And they wrote more about their experiences in medical school and how they were affected by it and so forth, where the Monday night group had third and fourth year students, some second year students, but residents and faculty. There were also some faculty members in the other class as well. They tended to write more about clinical situations, some of which were imagined, some of which were based on real situations.
So somebody sitting out there now saying, wait a minute, what in the world does writing a play with a third-year medical student have to do with this young person's ability to become a better doctor?
Well, there are a number of things that happened. One of them was, and one of the students commented, that they, by observing, creating characters and seeing other people's created characters, they had more of a sense of the whole person, because in the play there were motivations of the character, there were events that happened and how they reacted. And they got the sense of again, the whole person. The people are multifaceted. They have motivations. They have feelings. They have thoughts. which sometimes we tend to forget as physicians when we're so involved with the science of taking care of people. So that was one thing that happened. I think some of them, a number of them, I think, developed a sensitivity to that. The other thing was this sense of community that developed. There was a wide range of people in these classes, some students, some residents, some faculty members. And there was some mentoring that went on, you know, from some of the older faculty members. But as a faculty member, I learned things from the students, too. So there was a lot of exchange of feelings and thoughts and insights in the course of we actually, when these plays were written, we performed in our plays in front of each other. So there was this chance to sort of get insight into how people were thinking. And that doesn't happen a lot, particularly in the first and second year where people are so engrossed in science issues that they're not sharing their thoughts and feelings with each other. And this was a great opportunity for that to happen. So I think there was an awareness of the fact that we as physicians, medical students, healthcare professionals share a lot of things, common humanity, that we just don't talk about with each other or are even wanting to be aware of or admit to ourselves. And this, again, can be translated to patients. If you're aware of your own sense of humanity and your own issues, it just makes you more aware of patients' issues as well and better able to relate to them.
I would imagine, though, that breaking down those deflector shields and that barrier is very, very difficult and challenging.
Well, I think the fact that, you know, we were led by people in the creative field is something that helped that. It brought, I mean, some of the students commented it tapped into my creative side, which I've not even been that aware of since I've been in medical school. But the barrier issues, I think I was more aware of in the healer's art class, where we dealt with issues such as grief and loss. When a student has to share losses in their lives and how they reacted to it and dealt with it, people realize there are a lot of commonalities between us. And the important thing is, and I always ask the students at the end, what did you learn from these sessions? And they always comment that they learn that the same things in their own lives apply to patients. For example, if they're aware of losses in their lives and how they deal with them, they become more aware that patients have losses. You know, they may have loss of bodily function. They have loss of health. They have all kinds of things they have to deal with that we as physicians frequently don't pay attention to because we're more interested in the medical and scientific aspect.
So, look, you're dedicating your life, to be blunt about it, to bringing this sense of humanity into the training of medical students, which is a coming from the outside, a very scientific-focused curriculum. And you're trying to, you know, carve out this sense of don't forget you're a human being and your humanity can play a part in treating individuals, which you're dedicating your life to. How challenging is it now for the – are you sensing in medical schools a gradual shift in approaching the teaching of humanity, for want of a better term? I don't know what other term to use.
I've seen this shift in medical students over the years. I think there's more of that now. I think medical schools are being more discerning about the students they're admitting. It's not just their scores on the MCATs, you know, the standardized test, and their grades. It's how they are as people. And I think that that's showing itself in how the students are receptive to this. I actually teach a course called Introduction to Clinical Medicine. It's just a couple of hours once or twice a month. And there was a student's choice issue last year and where the students could choose. And I offered to them that I could talk with them about spirituality in healthcare and what spirituality is. And they immediately said, oh, yes, we want to hear about that. I was somewhat shocked, you know, when we had a wonderful session on it. And I think that they're finding that they have to go into other areas to find meaning in their work. That's the whole thing, is finding meaning. And if you have that compassion toward a patient and have a rich experience taking care of the patient, that's nourishing to the physician as well. And I think that's one of the things that we need more of.
So as we start to move towards the end of this segment, you raised this whole issue is spirituality and the Remen course. And I would imagine, well, I, I would imagine, I would hope, that even the play curriculum, the theater curriculum, would open the door to some of these students' own sense of spirituality. And I know you've written about this and we've talked about this. How open are these students to talking about their own spiritual journey when it comes to their training and in dealing with patients?
Well, I discovered if they're given the chance, they will do it. Particularly in the healer's art, you must create a safe environment where students feel free to share things. And I will say in the healer's art course, that five-session course I talked about at the beginning, they share some very intimate things with each other. And that's because we try our best, and I think we're pretty successful about it, the faculty that teaches it, of creating a safe space. And the thing is, and this is really important, is when someone shares something, one of the aims of this course is not to fix it for the person, because we can't always fix things, but giving people the chance to share what's on their mind and their feelings and validating them by listening. That's the thing that, you know, is so lost in medicine today, the listening aspect of actually listening to a patient and hearing what they're saying. I think that moves them into this direction, and they realize that that feelings are important in medicine. There's a book that was just written last year called What Doctors Feel by a wonderful internist at Bellevue named Daniel Offrey, where she talks about the emotional aspects of being a physician. And to me, it's a groundbreaking book because it discusses a lot of these things that should be discussed and people don't want to discuss because sometimes it's painful and people don't want to go there. But my feeling is the more you understand yourself and are aware of your own feelings, especially when dealing with patients, the better you are to attune to patients and to be present for them. Being present is the important thing.
Is it okay, which may be the wrong term, for physicians as they're treating patients to let down those deflector shields a little bit and be vulnerable and to say, I've walked this walk, so I know what you're going through. I have a sense, as opposed to being that having that all the time that barrier, because clergy face the same issue about how much do we disclose about our own personal journey. What have you found in teaching these classes?
Well, I think that's one of the things about the healer's art, and also this playwriting class as well, is that the students become aware of their vulnerability. And they see the vulnerability in their fellow students and future fellow physicians. I think with patients, that's an important. There is, you know, obviously we have to have boundaries. It's not the physician's role to share their lives with the patient. But it's just that ability to tune in. And I think if there's something that you can share something from your life that may help a patient deal with something they're dealing with, I think that's okay as long as it's kept in perspective and that there is a balance. Because I think if a patient senses the vulnerability in a physician, it makes them feel more comfortable in sharing their own lives.
We've been speaking with Dr. Don Freeman, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine on the volunteer faculty here at Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia, on some very, very fascinating, I'm going to say, frontier teaching methods that Jefferson is involved with medical students. And so thank you, Don, and I know you're just going to hang out for a little while.
Thank you.
So I really do appreciate it. Really do appreciate it, and thank you for your contributions to the website and what you're doing with medical students. I think this is going to benefit. I know it is their patients as well as the students themselves.
Thank you.
We want to remind you also of another good friend of Boomer Generation Radio, Samaritan Healthcare Services and Hospice over in southern New Jersey. They wanted to ask me to remind you about the fact that we do a lot of talking in our lives about things like the weather and my favorite sports. But very few of us talk about, in many cases, things that matter most. If surgery, an accident, or a serious illness prevented you from speaking for yourself, would your loved ones know your wishes, and would you know theirs? So Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice reminds us that now is the time to think, to talk, and to act. Think about what you'd want if you couldn't speak. Talk about your wishes with those who matter to you, and act by writing it down. Experts, as we've discussed here on the show, agree that the right place to have these delicate conversations is around your kitchen table, not in the ICU in a crisis. Think of these talks as your gift to your loved ones to communicate wishes, prevent family burden, and to avoid disagreements during crisis times. If you already have an advance directive, find out today about how talking the talk goes far beyond the legal living will with your lawyer that may have helped you complete this. And for tips and resources to help you begin these timely conversations, we invite you to visit SamaritanNJ.org/think-talk-act. That's SamaritanNJ.org/think-talk-act. And in truth, this weekend, with the Jewish community gathering around tables for Passover Seder and the Christian community gathering around tables for Easter dinners and discussions, let me suggest to you that this may not be such a bad time to think about initiating this conversation about your wishes as you move on in your life. It's a delicate conversation to start, but I think, as Samaritan is suggesting, when the family is together, this may be a very, very good time to start it. We'll be back with the second segment of Boomer Generation Radio in just a couple of seconds. Welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio, being brought to you by Kendall Outreach, serving the field of aging by raising public awareness and advocacy around important issues of older adults. Through education and training and comprehensive, safe, and individualized long-term care practices, Kendall Outreach has been sharing Kendall's approach to quality care with consumers, advocates, providers, government agencies, and related organizations since 1989. To learn more, we invite you to visit kendall.org. That's K-E-N-D-A-L. And when you do so, click on Outreach. Again, this is Boomer Generation Radio coming to you live from WWDBAM 860 here in the Delaware Valley and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. A reminder that you can contact the show with ideas or comments on boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And go to Facebook page, Boomer Generation Radio on Facebook, and click on the like button. We'd love to know about you. And we are welcoming, thanks to Brett and the magic of technology, Dr. Robert Schreiber from the Hebrew Senior Life Center in beautiful Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Schreiber, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Hey, how are you? Now, how's Boston today?
Nice and sunny. It's going to be 50 degrees. Spring is here.
So let us pray. So is the snow melting?
It is melting, but we have a lot of snow.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, listen, welcome. I really appreciate you coming on with us. Dr. Freeman, our professor from Jefferson Medical, who was our first segment guest, is in studio. We're very, very anxious to learn about what you're doing in Boston with this Vitalize 360, a coaching and assessment process for older adults that uses art and science to promote optimal wellness for successful aging. Tell me about what that means.
Well, hard question to do in a very short time, but I will try. This is a program that actually builds on what Don was talking about, the importance of really listening to the individual. And our mission is to engage and challenge, as well as inspire older adults to live as full and healthy, vibrant life as possible. And it also allows communities where these people live to demonstrate improvement in successful aging through a measurement system. We have a validated, scientifically grounded assessment system that was developed through a group called INTERI, the International Resident Assessment Instrument Group. And we use this as a assessment process to look at what happens to the individual over time, and we're able to aggregate this data. The process really looks at the individual. I mean, Don was talking about the spirituality aspect of it and the openness. And what we really try to do is to get at not one part of an individual, but look at the entire 360-degree view of the individual. And we encourage the older adult to really consider all aspects of their life, including health, nutrition, physical and mental fitness, community activities, social connections, spirituality, sense of purpose, and lifelong learning. And the coach actually helps guide and inspire and challenge the individual to create a full, vibrant lifestyle towards living the best life possible.
So this is a program where, let's say I want to do this, and I contact you, and there's a coach that's assigned to me, a person who walks me through this multifaceted or 360, I think it's called Vitalize 360, this process. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And now, who trains the coaches, and how are they trained?
Yeah, so the coaches, in terms of this process, we actually put coaches through a two-day training. They have to have certain types of criteria and capabilities in order to do this. The coach is really a facilitator. We're not looking at it as a paternalistic model, but somebody who has a conversation with the individual. And when we do the assessment initially and we have your initial conversation, it really is a conversation about what, you know, what your life has been like, what are some of your challenges, and we ask specific questions but are able to really, through a conversation, get to know the individual. So we actually do this two-day training. People practice it. We have also training that occurs afterwards. We have assigned mentors to the coaches, so that they can, you know, if they're having some challenges or issues, they can, you know, ask the question. We're also working in communities where they have other people available to, you know, access. And through this process, the individual, you know, is able to have this conversation. They go home with some homework to do, talking about what have been their, you know, biggest successes in life, what have been their biggest challenges. What are the things that they wish they could have done that they didn't get to do? And if they can, try to figure out what is really important to them. What type of legacy do they want to leave behind? What's really important to them now in the present day or will be important to them in the future? And have them really reflect and write down their feelings. The individual then comes back at another meeting after we've had a chance to look at the assessment and sort of get a printout of what the opportunities are for improvement for the individual. Not what's broken with them, but what are some of the things that we find might be an issue or concerns that they want to work on. But we listen first to what they tell us and try to develop a plan that's really a life plan, a life care plan, not a medical care plan, but a care plan of how they want to live their life. And based on what we found with the assessment, we then reflect on, oh, we found that there were some opportunities to improve your physical fitness because you're fatigued by doing your goal of traveling across the country to be at a wedding or, you know, a bar mitzvah or, you know,
visit the grandchildren.
Family event. We can then say, well, this is something you probably want to work on. How are we going to do that? And so through a Socratic method, individuals develop the sub-goals that will support their life goal. And through that process, the coach really is a facilitator more than an expert. It's not a sage on the stage, but somebody who's there to help the individual get the answers they need to be successful.
So right now, you're operating this out of Boston?
Yeah, so the places, we have 17 communities that are now doing this. In Boston, through the Hebrew Senior Life community, we have two continuing care retirement communities, as well as three supportive housing and urban development sites. And then the Kendall sites, we have another 12 sites through Kendall, including Kendall Outreach. So we have 17 communities at this point, and we're looking at expanding this to another 8 communities that are not necessarily in the Kendall and Hebrew Senior Life family, but have been doing something similar, a similar program, but now we'll take this to the next level.
So this program, the Vitalize 360 program, is right now just focused on existing facilities, correct?
These are facilities in the family of the Kendall and Hebrew Senior Life, and we're now in the process over the next year of expanding this across the country to like-minded organizations that really want to focus on what matters most to the individual.
So if I'm sitting here in beautiful southern New Jersey where I live, and I hear about this, and I'm saying, wow, this sounds pretty cool, I can get a coach to develop, to work with this whole life plan. I can't call you up in Boston and say, I want to enroll in this program. Is that correct?
At this point, no. But our hope is that if, in fact, you as an individual have a doctor or a medical group that is interested in doing this, there will be the opportunity. You know, the issue you bring up is we're doing this, you know, program has actually been in evolution for the last 5 years, mm-hmm. and we've done a lot of trial and effort, and we really need to make certain there's fidelity of the process, that we, you know, train people appropriately and correctly. However, you know, depending on where you live, let's say you're in Kendall Outreach, and that's an area where Kendall Outreach does, if you're connected to our communities, there would be an opportunity. If you're not connected to our opportunities, there is an opportunity if you had a system of care or a housing site or something where you were living, a community that was interested in doing this, we would then be able to talk to those community leaders and then see if there's a way we could bring this program out.
Okay.
At this point, we're sort of really in the, well, we sort of have, we're sort of in a little bit past infancy. We're sort of toddling at this point.
No, I understand.
So we're going very fast.
So in other words, but the individual, so me, just one person who may be listening to this, say, this sounds cool. I just can't call you up and say, how do I enroll in this? That's not where this program is focused. It's more on the working with communities or institutions or healthcare provider institutions, which is cool.
At this point, that's correct.
So,
hoping that this approach to what matters most to individuals will be adopted by, you know, medical systems, healthcare systems, you know, educational centers that, you know, as Don was talking about, listening to what matters most and what's important to the individual. We think there's a lot of validity in our process, and we are informing conversations specifically with meaningful use in the electronic health records, that when you go in, that part of the electronic health record should have a spot in it where your goals and what's most important to you are, in fact, you know, right on the top of the page. So even though you can't necessarily get into this program yet, we are helping to impact the way the whole system will be asking the question and getting to hear what matters most to the individual.
Yeah, I think this is it's very fascinating, because we've had on the show just in the last 6 months people who talk about creating a financial assessment plan, a personal financial plan for boomers as we age. And we've had people talk about creating for our same generation a care plan, just sitting down and talking about what type of care arrangements as we age out, especially for people who have relatives and children who live far away. So a financial assessment plan, a care assessment plan, and now we're talking with Vitalize, a real life, a holistic life plan from everything from exercise, nutrition, to legacy, et cetera, et cetera. I guess the question is, and I find this fascinating, is why? Why now? What's going on, and I have a feeling that it has a lot to do with our own generation's desires to seize a lot of control over our own aging. What are you finding as you, because you're in a lot of communities, 17 communities already, so you have a, a pool now of people who you could probably say, well, this is the motivation. What's going on here, doctor?
Well, that's a really... I don't think this is necessarily... I mean, I've been around a long time, and I don't know how old Don is, but when I was trained, we were actually trained to really ask what matters most to the individual. And then through technology and as more medical information and specialization occurred, we became much more disease-centered and focused. But, you know, when I was growing up, my family doctor used to make home visits. He knew everything about the family. He knew what was important to my parents. He knew what, you know, I wanted to do. I mean, we had those personal relationships, and I think we've sort of lost that. So I would like to think, even though the boomers, there is a boomer focus here because it is really what matters most to them. I really think what we're doing is getting back to the roots of what good, you know, basic healthcare is about and getting to know really what the individual. And I would suggest that you really can't provide a good financial plan, a medical care plan, without understanding what an individual's ultimate goal is. That will drive their financial plan. That will drive their medical care plan. So I almost look at this as this life care plan is the overarching goal, the holistic goal. And in that, you have a financial plan that supports your life goal. You have a medical care plan that supports your life goal. You have a spiritual care plan that supports your goal, but it's about your life goal. And I can tell you that the way this was brought home to me was many years ago. It was a story that I'd like to just share quickly. There was a gentleman that I took care of by the name of Albert. And I was working in a federally qualified health center that was, you know, for people that were impoverished in Danbury, Connecticut. And Albert came in to want, and he wanted to interview me. You know, it wasn't like there were a lot of doctors available there. So I said, fine, I'll talk to Albert. And he said, you know, he asked me a lot of questions and then said, look, I think you can be my doctor, but I have one request. I want to make certain that when I see you, you will let me tell you three jokes. And you have to do that every time I see you. And I said, Albert, really? Three jokes? Are they the long jokes? He said, come on, Dr. Shriver, I know you're busy. No, they'll be short jokes, but I want to do this. And I said, okay, well, why? And he said, well, you know what? I just want to do that. So, you know, I was busy and I just, okay, fine. So, you know, we do this and every time Albert comes in, he tells me jokes. Well, one day Albert was, you know, came in. I was running behind. I had a couple of significant emergencies. And the nurse comes in and says, you know, Albert's here and he's going to want to tell you three jokes. So just be prepared. He told me, make sure Dr. Shriver keeps his bargain. So, you know, Albert comes into the room. He sees that I'm harried and, you know, he sits down and says, well, okay, Dr. Shriver, I'm going to tell you three jokes. I said, okay, Albert. So, you know, I'm like pacing about. He said, no, Dr. Shriver, you need to sit. So the first joke he tells me, which was really funny, I did not react to. And he said, come on, Dr. Shriver, that was my funniest joke. You got to loosen up here. Second one, I started laughing, and the third one, I was rolling on the floor. So I asked him, I said, why is this so important to you? He said, look, you're busy, you know, you're working hard, I appreciate what you do. I want just to make a little difference in your life. But I didn't really want to know why this was important. I didn't ask him the right question. Why is this so important to you? Why is this a purpose in your life? Why are you doing this? I found out after he died several years later from a malignancy when his daughters came in to thank me and brought his obituary in that he was the most sought after chauffeur in New York City in the 50s and 60s where all the stars and starlets when they came into New York City, requested him personally by name. And the reason being is no matter how hairy their life was, no matter what was going on, he could make them laugh. So here I was taking care of Albert without understanding truly what his life goal was. And I said, you know what? This has to change. And that really was the impetus for this program.
Wow. First of all, it's a great story. I actually have a colleague, a retired colleague, who lives here in suburban Philadelphia, and that's what he does when he goes to see his doctor. He tells a couple of very, very good jokes, some of which I can't repeat, but that also raises, and Dr. Freeman's still in the studio, you know, this vitalized and the whole holistic approach in med, and we're seeing this beginning change in this return, I guess, as you were talking about, to a more holistic approach or personal approach or relational approach, whatever the correct word is. But there's a role for humor in the treatment of individuals, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think when we do this approach, that is front and center. It's about appreciating the things you do have versus, you know, focusing on the things what's, you know, broke or what's not working. And it does humor, relationships, meaningful discussions, and having fun is really what happens with these communities. And we have seen dramatic improvements of people's, community engagement, less depression, increased quality of life, and better assessment in terms of the way they perceive their health status. And we're in the process of submitting a paper for publication where we did a pilot of 75 of these people, and there was dramatic improvements, not only in quality of their life, but being delighted with their life. And again, we don't have hard data to show the cost, but we do have a lot of proxy measures to demonstrate people are living longer independently, and when they are ending, you know, their lives, they're at the end of their life, they're making decisions that are based on their goals, not what somebody thinks their goals are. And that's huge. So I think there's not only better health care, but we feel that this program will lead to lower cost based on the individual's goals, not based on societies or some system saying this is what, you know, you can and cannot have.
Dr. Friedman?
I just have a question for Dr. Schreiber. First of all, it's such a wonderful program, and your emphasis on the person as an individual is really so key. I just wondered, the information that you gather from your interviews and from the work with the coaches, is this conveyed to the person's primary care physician so they know what the patient's goals and aspirations and life purposes are?
Yes. With permission, the individual, their life goal is actually written out on a page, and their sub-goals are written out, so they have that. And we do encourage them to, you know, bring that to the primary care doctor, or we will fax it to their primary care doctor. Oftentimes in the communities, the primary care clinic is right on site. So there is an interdisciplinary team that meets actually about each one of these individuals. It's not just a coach. The community has other people that help these individuals, so we share those goals not only with the primary care doc, but with the interdisciplinary team, and there's a formal process by which we meet on a regular basis and update, you know, their situation and talk about how we can help them achieve their goals. But that does get shared, their goals. In addition, the standardized assessment prints out specific answers to questions that are critically important to the annual wellness exam that Medicare allows individuals now to have annually. So we actually send a printout to the primary care doctor that they can use as the basis for their annual wellness exam. It has already done about 80%, asked 80% of the questions and given answers, so the doctor can focus on actionable items rather than asking those questions. And that is, you know, kept in a standardized repository, you know, data repository, so that can actually be mined. But that is actually how it is being utilized now moving forward with the primary care teams.
That's wonderful.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Schreiber from the Hebrew Senior Life in Boston, talking about this very fascinating program that he's developed and working on called Vitalize 360, a very holistic approach of a coaching program for us as we age, and a reminder as we begin to wind down that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. And we invite you to join Kendall in together transforming the experience of aging. And again, to learn more about Kendall, K-E-N-D-A-L, and you're hearing a part of their experience here with Dr. Schreiber, we invite you to visit www.discoverkendall.org. And again, the toll-free number to reach them is 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. Dr. Schreiber, we have a couple of minutes left in this segment. Here's one of those easy, hard questions. You know, give me your philosophy of life in 30 seconds. You're working in this rather exciting issue and environment of really restructuring aging. So if somebody asked you, as I am, define for me what you in your experience in life define as healthy aging.
Healthy aging, the way I would define it, is based on what an individual's ultimate goal is and having the capacity and the ability to reach that goal. Specifically, most individuals do not want to be burdens. They want to stay as functionally independent as long as possible, and we know that development of chronic disease or the lack of management of chronic illness can, you know, cause an individual not to be able to succeed in staying independent. So the goal is to really develop a community approach where an individual has the ability to reach their goals, has the ability to socialize, has a healthy environment, social environment, where they can get the right types of foods, they have access to good, you know, physical activity programs, they have mental stimulation, but most importantly, healthy aging is about having a purpose in life. When somebody gets up in the morning and there's a reason for them to be there, and they have a goal, and that's important not only to themselves but to others, that leads, I think, to really having a healthy life. And so if you can combine all those things in a holistic approach, you can get to healthy living. And I think one of the concept of healthy living is basically the blue zone. That was a concept developed by Dan Butner, who's a social worker who had turned into a journalist for National Geographic and went around the world and found these communities where people live very long lives, men and women, and have very little chronic illness and are physically active up until the time they die, and it's not uncommon for them to be 100 or over at the time of their death, living in the community.
So it is correct to say, as many people have, that this is all not depending upon the number of years that you have lived. This is really more of an approach. So the number doesn't matter.
That's correct. The number does not matter. It is an approach. But what we find is when people have purpose in life and they have that type of support system, guess what happens? They live longer.
Well, the three things as I go around the country doing workshops on my stuff on Jewish sacred aging, you mentioned them that keep coming up as people's concerns and fears. The idea of, I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to end my life alone. And I don't want to be involved with excruciating pain and suffering. And my sense is that your approach, this holistic approach, taking in the consideration of the person, the whole person and the whole person's environment, really can go a long way to alleviating those fears.
That is correct. And that's what we're seeing. And we're hoping as we study this more, that we'll be able to actually demonstrate that this works across all settings.
If somebody hears this and wants to get in touch with you to explore getting involved real fast, we have about a minute left, how do they do that?
Probably the best way would be to email me, or they can actually go through Kendall Outreach, and that would, you know, given the fact you've been giving that number, but my email is rschreiber, S-C-H-R-E-I-B-E-R, at hsl.harvard.edu.
Dr. Robert Schreiber from Vitalize 360 and in Boston in the Hebrew Senior Life, thank you very, very much. It's a very, very interesting hour. And again, focusing on the bottom line of it's about the individual and being in touch with the individual and that individual's hopes and dreams and wants and goals. They go a long way. It's very reminiscent of a very, very interesting guy by the name of Moses Maimonides in the 12th century, who somehow came up with a lot of this many, many centuries ago. And glad to see that we're coming back to some of this. So thank you very much. I wish you, first of all, continued success with this, a good holiday. Thank you very, very much for being a guest here on Boomer Generation Radio. Dr. Freeman, thank you for hanging around and staying with us. To all of you, Have a wonderful holiday season, Easter, Passover. Just stay healthy, stay well, stay safe, and we'll see you next week on Boomer Generation Radio. Thank you, Dr. Schreiber.
Thank you.